Accession number 27308, Reel 8.
Ronald Walsh, Reel 8.
Yeah, well, as I said, I went with the Minesweepers to do the North African torch business, but I didn't go right through it because they went on to 1944 before they came home. But a funny thing happened. We were at sea one day, and we'd just finished a sweeping exercise, and we had to go into Bone Harbour, either for replenishments like fresh water or fuel, I don't know what, but we had to go in, and we were going to be in there about an hour or two, a couple of hours into Bone. And at a normal working day, we went in, we went alongside, and we secured, and there was a sailor on the jetty with his bag and hammock, which was, you'd never see. He had his bag and hammock, and he was standing on the jetty. And anyway, I was working on the seaboat. I wasn't very interested until about 10 minutes later, the first lieutenant came up, and he said, "Hey, you got a draft." I said, "What?" He said, "You're on draft." He said, "That bloke on the jetty is your relief. He's come out to relieve you." I said, "What for?" He said, "I don't know, do I?" He said, "But you're on draft. I'm going to put you on that jetty in half an hour. You've got to have your bag and hammock packed, and you've got to be on that jetty." I said, "Oh." I said, "Well, the only thing I can think of is that long before we left, out of the blue, I wanted another break ashore, and I put in a request to qualify for a higher submarine detector, which was about a six-month course up in Dunoon and that again." So I said, "Oh, surely they're not going to follow that up. To go back home to UK to do a higher course." He said, "Well, that's it." I said, "Where do I go then?" He said, "I can't tell you." He said, "All I can tell you is that I'm going to put you ashore, and that you've got to go up that road there, some road." He said, "There's a row of bungalows up there, civvies." He said, "They're all, the natives are all in." He said, "But one of them's got a big pole in the front garden with a white ensign up the top. That's our barracks. It's run by a sub-lieutenant on his own. So you go and report to that sub-lieutenant and tell him you've got to get back to Algiers with your bag and hammock." I said, oh yeah. So anyway, then I was bundled ashore, and off they went. I never saw them again. That was it. They were ever gone. Now, I would like to make it. After the war, there was a bit in the Malta Times about the famous minesweeping flotilla, the 12th MS. I'm quoting this little bit. "After 3 years operational sweeping in the Mediterranean, during this time their bag had totaled 2,715 mines and 320 obstructions, and the flotilla had swept the Allied invasion forces into enemy-occupied ports from North Africa, Sicily, Salerno, and the whole west coast of Italy. Their total score is the highest attained in the Mediterranean flotilla." That was it. That was a quote of what they did out there. So 2,700 odd mines, and obstructions were anything, you know. Anyway, as I said, I was now landed on this undesirable place in North Africa, and told to get about 100 odd miles back to there. No draft yet, no provisions, no nothing. So I goes along and finds this bungalow, and there's this young lieutenant, sub-lieutenant in there, and he says, "Well, we're the RN shore base here." He says, "So I've got about five other blokes here." He said, "I've got to get back to Algiers." He said, but it's a bit difficult because, he said, we got the single line railway from Algiers right through here to Bowen Phillipville and on down, supplying the 8th Army with all their equipment. So that line has got priority. It's single line and it's got priority for the 8th Army. So I don't know yet how I'm going to get you up there. He said there's lots of sidings up the way and it looks like you'll start from here and you'll go into sidings for a couple hours, maybe half a day, and then let the others through, let the supply trains through, and then you'll go on in steps like that till you get to Algiers. In the meantime, he said, there ain't much I want you to do, he said, except be here for sunset, that's in the night when he pulls his flag down, and in the morning when they turn two. And when so he said, that's all. He said, you can do what you like. So we used to go poking around, you know, not this bit or whatever. There were sunk ships in the bay. If you could get on them, you could have a look around. But anyway, after a couple of days, he said to me, there were a few of us, he said, I've got a job for you. I said, oh yeah, what's that? He said, about a half hour now, you'll get a platoon of Italian prisoners of war. They'll be coming along here. He said, and you'll be looking out for them. He said, they're employed in repairing the school, the local school that was bombed the other day, and they're repairing the bomb damage in the school. I said, what do you think I'm going to do then? I don't speak bloody Italian or nothing. He said, no, you'll be all right. There's a corporal in charge of them who gets through most English. He's a bit broken English, but he can manage. He's going to look after them. So anyway, this crowd comes along and the corporal says to me, right, I will deal with these. All you got to do is be with us until we get to the school. We got to the school and then he said to me, right, now there's a nice little room in there, comfortable, and you can stay in there or do what you like, and when I'm ready, when we go off tonight, I will collect you. We'll all go back and that we'll do that routine. You don't need to do anything, he said. They won't run away. They'll be here all the time. That I had 2 days of that, and then the sub-lieutenant said, you're off tomorrow. You're off tomorrow. We got a train going up there. You'll be these big cattle trucks where the doors come open at each side. So we used to go and we got on these. No provisions or nothing, just our bag and hammock, and we had to wait, depending how long we got, before we got to Algiers. And that could be 2 or 3 days. Anyway, we're sat there. We used to sit in the open doors, they'd be right back. They were both sides, but we'd have one side open. And we'd go along a few miles and then into a siding, and then these trains would come. Sometimes they'd go right through. Other times they'd stop beside us, you know, we'd be side by side. And I said, the second day, we hadn't had much to eat, it was getting a bit tricky, and we stopped. We went into a side, and this supply train came up, and it stopped right alongside us, and it was loaded with supplies for the 8th Army. Mostly tin stuff, you know, in crates of tin stuff. And all that lot, and it was on open flat trucks. Some of them, most of them, were open flat trucks. There were a couple of, but on top of each truck, there was an American army bloke with a rifle across his knees. See, well, obviously they'd had trouble with the locals, so we came up there. We're sat there, and there's less than about 8 feet from us was this train with all these supplies on, and we hadn't got nothing, you know. So we thought we'd chat up the old guard, like, and he was watching us very carefully, and we got, you know, hello there, Yank, how you doing? All right, you know. And then he'd say, if you've got any ideas of those stores, forget them. because he said, this baby will deal with you, and he lifted his rifle. We thought, oh dear, he's not very common, you know. So we had to work out a problem. What we did is we opened the other side doors, and then two of them went out that side of the train. They went along, and then they got underneath the other this train that was there. So the one behind, who was on top of the others, and this one up here, couldn't see them. And what they did, they were very frail, the crates they were in, you know, and they were great big 7-pound tins, round tins. We didn't really know what was in them, but there must have been something. So we kept the old guard up there. We kept upsetting him, you know. And he was so concentrated on us that they were able to reach up and break open the small and get about three tins. I think we got about three or four tins. And they went back along underneath, up through the other side, and hid them under our hammock net up there. So they were in, then they went off. We never had that opportunity again, because they'd gone, but we weren't worried, because when we got these tins open, they were full of apricots and pears and plums, all that sort of fruit. Okay, it wasn't corn dog or nothing like that. It was all fruit, which was enough for us. We'd sit there with great big tins, getting back pears and apricots and all that lot, you know, and we were quite happy with that. And then when we'd get along, you'd go alongside into a village, and then all the little herbers were... When we got near Algiers, we found we had maybe half of these tins left, all, you know, we had plenty of them. And all the little natives would come round, so we gave them tins. They thought they had pots of gold. Off they went. They were happy. And then we got into Algiers, straight in the dock, and reported, given a good meal and a bath and all that lot, and put on a trooper the next day for UK. So when we got back to UK, I thought, oh, I'm all right now. I'm going to do a better six-month course for HSD or a submarine detector, you know, up in Scotland, lovely. So I goes in the barracks and I said, oh, yeah, what are you then? I said, oh, I'm from HMS Q. Oh, yeah. What you, I said, well, obviously I'm going on, I'm doing HSD's course. Oh, we'll have a look. So they goes away, and oh, they come back. He said, you ain't doing no HSD. I said, no. He said, no, you're off to America. I said, what for? He said, oh, he said, you're picking up a ship out in America, so you'll be off in a couple of days over to Boston or wherever you go, and on your luck, he said, you'll have to do your HSD after the war or something. So I'm on my way to America on the Aquitania, the liner, and that's when I went out and picked up HMS Kingsmill.
Can you tell me about that voyage out on the Aquitania? Did she sail on her own, or was she...
She sailed with a... As I remember, it was with a convoy for so long, and then we got away after and went in alongside at Boston. And it wasn't very clever, I tell you. We were bunged down in the bottom of the ship somewhere. It was blooming. It was a terrible voyage. We were heaped together, and as soon as we got in, half of us sailors were immediately shoved in the sick bay. And treated for crabs, and they didn't hang around, strip off on there, bang out with a razor, and that was it, and you were supposed to be clear of the crabs.
And that was conditions purely on board the ship?
Purely on board that trooper going out there, we got that. But that was cleared up in no time, and then we went through, we went out there in October of 43, and we came home a couple of days before Christmas. When the ship, we lived over in America, in Fargo Barracks and Asbury Park, with the Yanks, fiddled in the Yanks' messes, cereal in the morning, sweet after dinner, everything you wanted. Go round twice. We had all that time, about a couple of months out there, and then we picked up these two ships were ready, that I said were going to be for Gold Beach.
And what was yours called again? What was your ship that you were drafted to called again?
Kingsmill, HMS Kingsmill.
And she was the diesel electric captain's
class. Yeah, diesel electric frigate. Yeah, they were all new vehicles. They built them in no time. A couple of weeks and you had a new ship there, sort of thing. You know, they were knocking them off. Altogether, I still belonged to the Captain's Class Association. There were 70-odd ships, 75, I think, that we had, and they all did very good Atlantic convoy work and other work all round. And the only two was the Lawford and the Kingsmill that were destined for Gold Beach on D-Day.
Again, your role would have been as ASDIC operator, would it, on board?
Yeah. More or less. I mean, we were, but there were other duties as well on there, obviously. In when we were off duty, wartime, we had to do whatever was required. Upper deck work and everything.
Did you have a different action station again?
on there, that... It varied. Sometimes you only need one operator on, so if you were four of you, you might have been detailed for the ASDICs, and the others would be on a gun. I know on the acute, I was on the starboard Orlikans, twin Orlikans, ACAC guns, very efficient. I had them when we were charging round and round in Algiers Bay. I had the starboard Orlikans. And I was hammering away with them. One of them, you only had one on the crew. If you had enough, you had a loader, because the ammunition was in big pans, which you could lift up and just put on the top, and then it was fed through like on a belt. So that was that.
When you were on the Kingsmill, was it just you were part of a gun crew? You'd be detailed to a gun crew, would you?
No, on the Kingsmill, I was ASDIC operator. But then again, I wouldn't record because, although after we'd done all the running up and the exercise, mind you, we didn't know what was coming, because as soon as we got back to UK, we went to Liverpool and we had an extra mast put on. At the stern end of the ship, they poked another mast up with aerials, which obviously were for the extra communications and signals ratings we were going to have on. So that mast was there, put there. The only two of us had two masts, us and the Lawford. And we hung around before June the 6th. We were hanging around. We'd completed all our exercises that we had to do. And we were anchored off Gurnard, off the Isle of Wight.
Can you tell me about those? Obviously, you know, you've got a new ship. How did it compare with British ships? And what were the exercises that you had to do?
Well, they were all much the same. Not a lot of difference at all. I'm here.
I was wondering with the American ones, because I have heard that some of them had bunks and one or two of them had things like ice cream makers.
Ah, yeah, they're minor things. A lot of them did have bunks. Quite frankly, I don't even remember what I had, because we were up and down. I think we did have bunks, because I don't remember slinging hammocks. But anyway, there are a lot of differences, as you say. Ice cream parlours and all that simply would be turned into canteen for us. Get away with the ice cream, shove in the old chocolate bars in that canteen. That was it. And if you had bunks, then you were lucky. Other than that, you made do.
Were they more comfortable than, say, a British ship?
Oh, yeah, they were pretty comfortable. You managed all right. No ship, I'd say, was comfortable, but you managed all right. And we had these extra things fitted, the extra mast, and also we had extra armament fitted, all us two, the Lawford and us. And we did all the run up. When it was all finished, we still didn't know. We were laying off Gurnard, the Isle of Wight, for about a week, and nothing happening, you know. And then come the 3rd and 4th of June, just before, everything was happening. People were being brought on board. Extra people were brought on board. We had a lot more signal ratings. And just on the 5th, we had a load of... army officers, and they came on board, and we knew something was up there. We said we knew it was invasion, but where from we didn't know. Anyway, come the 5th, we didn't sail because of the weather. I think it was late on the 5th or whenever, we went to sea, and we got all these ships just seemed to be going out to sea, and we got out, and it would have been, I think it must have been late the 5th, because the actual invasion was 6th. And we got out into the open water, and there you could see anything but ships, and all round you, all sorts, navy ships, everything. And it was just unbelievable. And of course, having got out and clear, it wasn't going to be very long. It was only the next forenoon, next morning. By dawn, we'd know what was what. So where we were, steaming along there, and then everything went on all right, with planes going overhead, a lot of planes, everything happening. We got in, and dawn started breaking, and then they started opening up from the beach, from the gun batteries, the shore, and everything. And then I started barraging all the Navy ships, hammering out aircraft, hammering out ammunition was going, you know, and there was shells flying everywhere. A noise and a war. It started with daybreak. You were in a war, and bombs going up everywhere. And the big ships, I must say, some of the big ones that were laying off, our big ones, were hammering away with their big guns, and the cruisers with their triple six inch turrets hammering away. Even my old ship, the Glasgow, was there, but she was with the Yanks on the other beach, and, further along. She got a direct hit, the Glasgow. Not much damage, but that went on. Now, what happened then is I found out from the Ministry of Defence, what our actual duties were as a headquarters ship, which no one knew until, well, I don't know, until I happened to get it from the MOD. I've got a complete outline of what happened. And we were responsible for the landing of so many regiments of some Northumberlands or whatever on Gold Beach, and to remain in during the action, to remain close inshore, anchored, and support. So the army officers were doing all that. The extra communications rating were getting away all the signals. And obviously, over a short range, they didn't close up Aztecs because you had minesweepers in front. So my job when we got there, I reported to the on deck, you know, we fell in the morning amongst all this lot, and he said, right, I was leading seaman then. I was one of the crew that were on the quarter deck of, we went in, anchored close inshore, and started our WhatsApp. And my job was on the quarter deck all through the day. All of that day, we were bringing in wounded off the beach, straight off the beach. They would come out from the Gold Beach, which was only just over there, and they were loaded into the landing craft. So they were all laid out on the bottom of these landing craft, where they all, and they would come along to our starboard quarter, alongside on the starboard side of the quarter deck. We would get them in to us through the minesweeping deck, where there was a Harley Street surgeons and specialists that would deal with them initially, and then the other side of the ship into landed ships that would take them out to the hospital ships, which would bring them back to UK immediately. You know, it was that off the beach to us, from us to the hospital ships, and then back to UK. So I was on that all day. All day long, you saw bodies, army, mostly army, or with all their kit on, floating by you all day long, some looking up, some looking down, all, you know, just floating away, but all through the forenoon anyhow. And then in the afternoon, you still saw a few. They were all just floating away out to sea. Everything was happening on the beach, you know. And
what could you see when you were looking across at the beach? What was the scene?
Well, all you could see is a big action going. I mean, you could see all the firing and then the bombs and all that. Like, I mean, just like an action.
And were you dealing with quite a lot of wounded that day?
Oh yeah, all the morning and well into the afternoon. They were getting them. They were off the beach. I mean, they were. Sometimes the mine went up under the landing craft, and all you saw up in the air was bodies being blown up in the air. And when they came down, they usually either went on the beach or they were drifted up on the beach.
And were the Germans returning fire?
Oh yeah, they weren't very. Oh yeah, Germans were returning plenty of fire from ashore. Oh yeah. And in fact, on the beach next to us, that was the American beach. They had it bad. They couldn't get a hold at all. And they lost thousands on that day alone. They lost thousands. I mean, Cherbourg and up around there, they had the big guns going.
And you were just dealing with the wounded over that period of time. Did it slacken off in the later afternoon?
Well, yeah, the later afternoon. By the evening, we'd finished. They'd got most of them off the beach and out to us or wherever they were going. But they came to us, a lot of them. I don't know if any others were taking them.
What, you mentioned that there'd been, you know, Harley Street surgeons and that type of people on board.
Well, I'm presuming they were. I mean, I didn't know whether they came from Harley Street or Bournemouth, but they were specialists. They were specialist surgeons and medical staff to deal with the injured that they knew would be coming off the beaches.
Had the ship been kitted out specially with medical facilities for this?
Oh, yeah, we were kitted out with everything. We had extra, I don't know, we could have had a dozen doctors, surgeons, whatever. But I mean, we didn't go around poking our nose, and everyone was doing what they had to do. You had a heap of surgical people, medical staff and all that lot, extra staff, all to cope with all this. And it all happened in the first 2 days. After they'd got a hold in that, I mean, they all went back to where they came from, and that was it.
Were you still doing it on the morning of the 7th? Were you still bringing wounded stuff on the shore?
No, we finished up. I think we cleared the beaches by early evening, I think, because after that we were there and we patrolled up and down in the area for the next two or three weeks. The Lawford that was with us, we went over on the 6th, and on the 8th, early 8th of June, the Lawford had gone out to investigate some e-boats that were hanging around somewhere.